We all have to deal with bureaucrats and bureaucracies, and it's a real pain. We are passed from ministry to town hall, from region to region, from department to department. Our letters are not answered. Our phone calls are not returned. Our files go missing. It seems like an unwinnable battle. It is nothing of the kind. Bureaucrats are immensely vulnerable in all sorts of ways, and to pierce their armor, all you need is some insight into their mental processes and a working knowledge of the tactics and techniques that will give you the best chance of victory. Let's take as our example the course of a typical major public protest. The protesters are the people who live in a community blighted by the threatened assault of planners and developers. The first rule is that of eternal vigilance. You see, the crazy thing about protesting is that the time when you are most likely to succeed is the time when you are least likely to act. It's at the very beginning of the project that you have the best chance. Now, put yourself in the enemy's mind for a moment. For our purposes, let's make him one of the most formidable of enemies, Sir Humphrey himself, a government department. Someone needs a motorway, a refuse tip, a superstore. It is now that considerations come in. Some of them are obvious, cost, efficiency, and so on, and they will narrow the area of choice for the point of territorial aggression. But after them come the imponderables like amenity value and community disruption. And now the slightly less honorable considerations appear. In particular, what will cause the officials least trouble? Does place A mean lengthy and complicated geological surveys? Does place B mean endless boring discussions with the Ministry of Defense about releasing an artillery range? Is place C dangerously close to the Lord Lieutenant's pheasant shoot? Does place D mean drawing up a completely new set of plans and estimates instead of digging the old ones out of the file? What is wrong with place E? What is wrong with place E is that you live there, all unaware of the project and of the considerations revolving in official minds. If only you could find out now, you could try and indicate what was wrong with place E, namely, that it would cause a violent public outcry and a long, drawn-out, bitter battle against a well-organized, determined, and vicious group of citizens. As soon as you get wind of any plans, you must act urgently and by telephone. Letters are useless at this stage. It is the menace, the tone of voice you're after. It's even reported that people have succeeded in disguising their voices and pretended to be from the local authority when they phone the ministry. You know, we keep being pestered by this boring little man who says you're going to build an open prison in his garden. Could you let us know what actually is being discussed? All this may sound devious and tedious. So it is. But it's worth it if it enables you to whip up local frenzy before anything is finally decided and nip the plans in the bud. But assuming you fail, then your enemy has appeared, and you must organize your resistance. The enemy at this stage is not the council, or the ministry, or the officials, or anyone else. The enemy is the plan itself. When the plan is published, you will not regard it as a document at all, but as an act of naked, iron-fisted, territorial aggression. All the same, a cool appraisal is essential. So wait till your heart stops thumping and your breathing returns to normal, and then sit down and study it carefully. You'll get nowhere unless you look at the plan from the standpoint of Sir Humphrey and his colleagues, the men who drew it up. They've been at it for months. It has generated several major internal rows. The chap who started it all off was promoted halfway through and moved to Edinburgh. It has meant a great deal of work and unpleasantness and getting home late for supper. And the thought of going back to square one gives them all nightmares. And yet, for all that, Sir Humphrey is proud of it. Proud at least of having turned out such a plausible and workmanlike job in the face of all the difficulties. Of course it has its flaws, but they're well disguised. Of course it will be attacked, but all plans are attacked. And on the whole, he's come to believe that as a practical project in an imperfect world, it is probably the best one around. To you, it appears the product of an exhaustive and comprehensive survey from which unarguable facts lead by irresistible logic to inevitable conclusions. That is how it is meant to appear. It is, however, exactly the reverse. It started as a quick decision by a busy man several years ago. All work thereafter has been directed at making that early decision stand up. Now, if you doubt this, reflect on London's third airport. All the arguments and statistics, we were told, pointed inevitably to Stansted as the only conceivable choice. Minister after minister dutifully mouthed the words of his officials to explain why no other site was possible. But one of the first glaringly obvious conclusions reached by Roskill was that Stansted was such a bad choice as not to be worth even shortlisting. The plan, therefore, is by no means the crushing and unanswerable fait accompli that it appears. And just as the plan is meant to look unanswerable, so the authority behind it is meant to look indivisible. You are meant to assume that all arms of government are united in their resolve to implement the plan without modification and without delay. Nothing could be further from the truth. The plan is a patchwork of compromises, not just between political representatives anxious to avoid a fuss and officials anxious to avoid tiresome extra work, but between different departments of the council, different ministries, between Town Hall and Whitehall. It follows that the worst thing you can possibly do at this stage is to force them to declare a public alliance behind the plan. In their internal dissensions lie some of your best hopes. The first response to the plan is all important. It has to be a public meeting, and it absolutely must be well attended. If only a handful of people turn up, you may never recover from it. If you get a packed hall, you have the beginnings of a great campaign. Now, this particular meeting is an emotional one, and you cannot make it into anything else, nor do you want to. It is about how people feel. Visible unanimity is important. Audible unanimity, even more so. It's better to shout out, "Do we accept the plan?" and get a roar of "No!" than ask for a show of hands. That can come later. And if you reach the pitch where the whole audience sings, "We shall not be moved," or "Jerusalem," or "Three blind mice," for that matter, you are well and truly on your way. The only practical result required from the meeting is that it should authorize the organizers to form an action committee to speak on their behalf. Now, who should serve on the action committee? This is an extremely delicate and sensitive decision, and one which can be embarrassing or even impossible to recover from if you get it wrong. There is, however, a clear principle, and there are also various useful dodges. The principle is that the action committee should comprise only the best people for the job. The delicacy of the decision springs from the number of people who do not qualify, and yet are valuable allies, and will be offended, perhaps mortally, if they are not invited to join. This is where the dodges come in. You can invent all sorts of other imposing institutions for the honor and glory of those you exclude. You can have a community council, to whom you formally report once a quarter. You can have an advisory council and a number of consultative committees. When the community council grows too large to be an honor, you can restore the dignity of the more senior by making them vice presidents. That still leaves you the valuable title of patron in reserve for the local bigwigs. Next, you have to face the fact that there is too much work for a single committee to undertake on its own. You're fighting an enemy with massive resources and vast statutory powers, and you have little enough of either. You're in the position of a guerrilla force, and you must use guerrilla tactics. You need small groups, carefully worked out targets, concealment, surprise, dedication, strong local support. The cells can almost operate independently, but in fact their strength is much increased if their work is properly coordinated when the leaders meet on the action committee to plan a concerted movement. The first cell is the grassroots. It must never be forgotten that this is the whole neighborhood's united opposition, not just the protest of a few NIMBY busybodies. You therefore have to keep in touch with everyone and make sure they feel they are part of the protest. You can only do this by a network of street and area representatives. The second cell is for fundraising. It's a poignant irony that the massive resources of central and local government come from your taxes and your rates, just as their authority comes from your votes. Nevertheless, a first-class protest can fail for lack of a few hundred pounds, and so you have to raise more money to fight the money you've already handed over to the enemy. The third cell is law. You are playing a game with complicated rules, and the rules are tucked away in any number of judgments and statute books. You need a cell headed by a lawyer thinking hard all the time about the legal side of the campaign. If you have no lawyer available, you may find you have a natural amateur lawyer in the community. Colin Seymour of Flamborough in Yorkshire has no legal training, but in 1997 he won his 81st successive case against the authorities using a 1765 enclosure law to stop the council uprooting a hedge. The fourth cell is that of the influential allies. This must be headed by your chairman, who should be the most respected and influential person who is committed to your cause. It is the chairman's job to use the old boy network to land the biggest fish in the district. All the names worth dropping. The fifth cell is made up of the experts. This cell contains the storm troops of your attack on the plan. You need professional people. Architects, surveyors, accountants, high-level civil servants, planners and top managers from large corporations, university lecturers, consultants, scientists. Their task is to attack the plan on its own terms. The sixth cell is for publicity, and for publicity, think politics. Hardly any protests involve enough voters to disturb the electoral security of a single borough councillor, let alone an MP. But once the affair gets into the press and radio and on television, a much wider spread of voter will be influenced. Your object is to start MPs and councillors wondering whether the railroading of this plan is worth the possible cost of their seats. The final cell is campaign headquarters. A fixed base can provide an address, a man telephone, and a fax, plus a bulletin board, an easy chair, and endless cups of tea. Headquarters should ideally be run by a domestic partnership. You need a fixer, the sort of person who has an extraordinary gift for getting unlikely permissions and extracting free facilities, who will borrow a string of polo ponies for you at a moment's notice. The other partner needs to be indefatigable, the sort of person who will try the engaged number for the seventh time, work steadily down a long list of tasks, and chase other people's progress with charm and relentless determination. Ideally, since headquarters is the hub of all information, you should also recruit the local gossip and nosy parker. Now, with your team in place, you are ready to plan your campaign tactics.